Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. At this time, we begin the technical net, by which the enthusiastic guys meet most Sunday evenings at 8 o'clock until the wee hours of the morning sometimes to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio. The subjects that are discussed on the tech net are the subjects that you guys bring as questions. Very rarely do we have a package program of a given subject ahead of time. A couple of exceptions to that occur when Mel, K2KEY, gave us a package program on things like decibels and the Smith chart and standing wave ratio. A couple of those have occurred over the years. It's nice to know that most of the material that you hear on the technical net, if you miss it the first time, there's a way you can go back to it. There's a very enthusiastic guy named Mike Perry, KC2NJI, who has recorded the last 6 years of the technical net, and it appears on the website www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. You go to that particular website, and 1 hour at a time, you can download the last 6 years' worth. And many of those years are documented as to what subject was being discussed during each 10 minutes. And there's also a couple of packaged programs there. In other words, certain popular subjects like decibels and standing wave ratio have already been gathered together into one location, so to speak. Lots of good information there. Also, that information on how to get a perfect impedance match to a dipole, which, believe it or not, seems to be a pretty well-kept secret. Okay, Mel, K2KEY, and Dick, K2RIW, do this thing by taking check-ins during the first hour. We try to make a sincere effort that those who sign in during the beginning of the first hour will get at least a brief answer to their question. Beyond the first hour, if Mel's available, we go to the mailbag of the new recruits who are coming into ham radio who have a bunch of questions and they can't yet get on the air because they don't have the equipment. Although I guess they could by way of internet techniques like IRLP. After that, Paul, WS2N, will tell us the latest of what's going on in space. And after that, after we get rid of the pre-programmed material, so to speak, we go over to almost any subject because it's my belief that inside of every real ham radio operator there's a scientist. And those people who express curiosity are the ones who are really making progress. So hams get curious on almost every possible subject. And lately we've been getting into what's going on at the atomic level and the molecular level, and what really is magnetism and gravity and so on. How does a radio wave really propagate at right angles to a piece of wire? Not always, but that's another whole subject. I'll take check-ins at this time. This is check-in number 1,373 of the series that began in September of 1982. This is the 29th year of the technical net. Kind of amazing it's been around that long. A person signs into the technical net because he does have a question or a comment by giving us his call letters, his name, and the word yes, which means he does have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this, W2OSR, Bob, and yes. So do we have any check-ins tonight? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
KC2GY, Russ, yes.
Yes.
Okay, that was a triple. I heard KC2GY, Russ, he won. Who was the other two?
WA2RYY.
Okay, that was Joe, number two. Who was the third one? Okay, so far we've got Russ and Joe. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KG2T. His name is Joe. No questions.
Okay, Joe with a no. Anyone else? Give me your call letters at this time.
WS2N, Paul, with the space report. Good evening, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. I hear you.
4 NBC, Bob, yes.
Okay.
KBAH, with an update.
Okay, we got K4 NBC, Bob, KB2BAH. And Mr. BAH, what is your name, sir?
Kevin.
Very fine, Kevin. Sounds like Bob and Kevin are possibly coming in by way of internet techniques. Okay, the first guy to sign in was Russ. KC2, I think it is, Gulf Yankee. You got it, Russ, K2LIW. My name is Dick.
Hey, Dick, it's Russ. Alpha Charlie 2, Gulf Yankee, AC, which gets confused with KC a lot. Anyway, my question is about horizontally and vertically polarized antennas. And if you could explain to me, what I'm trying to get my mind around is, how would that make a difference in the transmitting and received signal if stations had matched horizontally or vertical antennas or mismatched? How would that affect the transmitted and received signal? Back to you, Dick. AC2GY.
Now, what you're discussing, Russ, is now under the heading of polarimetry, polarization. Polarimetry is the exact science used by the radio astronomy people to measure the characteristics of a radio telescope source. Certain stars, for instance, because they've got a local magnetic field, might radiate a more vertically polarized energy than horizontal. They might be radiating more clockwise versus counterclockwise circular polarization. Particularly when it comes to circular polarization, you're going to find out a lot of people, including antenna engineers, have only a partial understanding. Okay, if you look at the classic picture of a dipole that was in most of the manuals that you studied when you first studied electronics or you studied the ham radio questions and answers, you saw a dipole as a half wavelength piece of wire broken in the middle. Usually the piece of dipole wire is laying parallel to the ground, and the transmission line goes to the center. Let me drop. And the energy coming out of your transmitter goes down that transmission line, and at one instant of time, the transmission line is driving the right-hand side of that dipole with positive voltage and the left-hand side with negative voltage during the first half cycle. And during the next half cycle, those two polarities reverse. So you cyclically put these voltage polarities, it's the method by which you're launching the energy, onto that dipole. The dipole itself has a certain length, half wavelength, quarter wavelength on each side. It takes a certain length of time for that energy to spread down that piece of wire. But still, as it does so, you could, with the right kind of instrumentation, measure the polarity of the voltage that's on the wire, each inch of the wire if you wanted to, in theory, during each microsecond or each nanosecond. And you would find out very rapidly that on that dipole, the highest voltage occurs at the outer tips. The lowest voltage, which is not zero, but the lowest voltage occurs near the center. So there's a certain distribution of voltage along the wire. And because of the tradition or the standards that were set up by the antenna people, a horizontal dipole launches a kind of signal that if you could see the signal in space, it has an E field that's horizontal and has an H field that's vertical. H field means magnetic field. So the lines of magnetic force coming off of that dipole, broadside to the dipole is where the maximum energy takes place. The magnetic field is vertical. The electrostatic field instantaneously is horizontal. And so at each plane of that wave coming toward you, I'm standing a mile away from that dipole, and a certain amount of energy is coming toward me, and the very first plane of that wave coming toward me, if I could stop time and look at it...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
Yeah, I hope I haven't timed out the other machine. By the way, each person should not do what I do. Make sure that you give an interruption every minute so that the whole machine setup can set up and can recycle itself. If I could look at that very first plane of the wave coming toward me, I'm standing a mile away, I could stop time and really study it, I would find out that to the left and right, I've got these lines of electrostatic force. In other words, at one instant of time, My right hand would measure a positive voltage. My left hand would measure a negative voltage. When I put my hands out horizontally, if you know what I mean. And the magnetic field at that same instant of time, maybe the magnetic field would be north, up, and south, down. So the lines of magnetic force are purely parallel lines that are completely vertical to the ground. The lines of electrostatic voltage are completely horizontal parallel lines, parallel to the Earth, and they're exactly at right angles to each other when you're far enough away, when the wave has completely straightened itself out. That's called a horizontally polarized wave because the wire that launched it is horizontal, also because the standard that's used by the antenna people is that you will describe the polarity of the wave as the polarity of the E field, not the H field, not the magnetic. The electrostatic field, the electric field, the direction it goes is called polarity. Now, if you and I set up a horizontal dipole in free space, where there's no reflection going on, let me drop. And a mile away, I've got a receiving dipole that's also horizontal, and I measure an amount of signal, which is very predictably mathematically. You can go to a fairly simple formula where you rate the insertion loss. So the insertion loss in decibels is 36.6 plus 20 times the log of F plus 20 times the log of D. F is frequency in megahertz, D is distance in miles. You plug in the F and the D to that formula, and some number of miles away you know exactly how much signal you're going to get, because in theory you know how much signal was transmitted in watts, you know how many decibels of loss there is between the two antennas, and therefore you can figure out how many microwatts, so to speak, of signal you're going to receive. It's all quite mathematical. If I took that receiving dipole and started horizontal where I got maximum signal, and I start slowly rotating that dipole in free space, and I'm slowly rotating it toward vertical, you'll soon discover it follows a cosine theta law. By that I mean, that the voltage that I see on the pickup dipole, and there are nine, that power is a function of voltage squared, by the way, you will find out that on this repeater and during the TechNet, there are people who like to be disruptive, so that when you hear disruptive signals, like people not allowing the machine to reset, and particularly beyond 11:30 at night, they seem to get a little bit more rigorous at that, please periodically press the reverse button on your receiver, on your transceiver, so you can hear the signal strength of what's going on in the input. By recording that signal strength and reporting it to K2IVX, that's Len at Limark, we collect those reports, and that gives us a good indication as to where the interference is coming from. And other than that, we don't address those people. They're a sad situation of somebody who hears other people enjoying their hobby, and they hope that if they can become disruptive, that they will increase their enjoyment because their life is not so happy for them. It's a sad state of affairs. We shouldn't get angry at them. We should feel sorry for them. So, as you slowly rotate that dipole toward vertical on a horizontally transmitted polarity signal, you'll find that the voltage that you pick up falls off as the cosine theta. In other words, a trigonometry function called cosine. Cosine of 0 degrees is 1, so when there's 0 degrees of difference, you're both horizontal, you'll pick up full amplitude. As you slowly rotate toward zero, toward the vertical, which is a 90-degree rotation, the cosine of 90 is 0. So in theory, you'll get no voltage at all when the two antennas are cross-polarized in free space. But now there's a bunch of catches to that one. In the real world, Russ, the real world has a property called chirality. That's a fancy way of saying that the polarity of what got transmitted and the polarity of what you receive. I'm now talking about polarization, I should say, not polarity. The polarization of what's transmitted and the polarization of what you receive may not be the same. By the time the signal bounces off the ground, and the ground's got a little bit of a tilt to it, it bounces off the water tower, the buildings, the trees, and everything else, the signal becomes much more random in polarization. And now in the real world, if you did that test between you and your buddy that's a mile apart, you would find out that the signal gets weaker as you cross polarize the antennas, but it doesn't quite go to zero. And the best example I've got of that is when I ran this experiment where I used to travel to Utica, New York with my automobile, and I had a horizontally polarized loop antenna on top of the car. I also had a vertical 5/8 wave whip and a switch in the car where I could rapidly flip back and forth between the two. And on 2-meter single sideband, I was holding long-range QSOs on single sideband 2 meters with K2TXB, Russ Pillsbury, who at that time was living in southern New Jersey, and I'm traveling up toward Utica, which is 200 miles north of him. And he and I were talking back and forth on 2-meter sideband. And while I'm on the New York State Thruway, let's say 100, 150 miles from him, and I'm flipping back and forth rapidly between those two antennas, there was no difference in signal strength. In other words, that signal that he was transmitting with his horizontally polarized Yagis on 100 feet of power in southern New Jersey, that signal by the time it sifted through hundreds of miles of trees and buildings and everything else, by the time it got to me, the polarization had been scattered so badly that there was no real difference between horizontal and vertical.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Only when I got up to a high-altitude scenic lookout where I could see 20 or so miles, then when I flipped back and forth between horizontal and vertical, without a doubt, the co-polarized, horizontally polarized signal gave me a lot stronger signal than the vertically polarized signal, because he was transmitting horizontal. But as you can see, it's very environmental sensitive. So far what you've heard about is simple linear polarization from a dipole or Yagi-like antenna. At some later time, Russ, we should discuss circular polarization, which is not popular on terrestrial communication most of the time. But when it comes to space communications, like talking to a satellite or doing moon bounce, then circular polarization, which is a little bit more complicated, has some distinct advantages. You haven't heard the whole story. You've heard sort of an introduction, but maybe it helps a little bit, Russ. AC2, Golf Yankee, K2RIW. You got it, Russ. Wait for all four beeps.
Thank you, Dick. You've given me some, you've definitely cleared it up, so I got a better understanding of the initial explanation, because I'm sure you could go on and on with more detail, but there's other people with questions, so might have...
Yeah, very fine, Russ. You're allowed to come back and re-ask the question as many times as you like to start digging into the deeper portions of it. Polarimetry and polarization characteristics of a radio errors that occurred in the field of science is the fact that the people who described polarization first seem to be the people are using the exact same electromagnetic spectrum. DC to light is all possible frequencies, and these two groups of scientists should be using the exact same definition. Oh boy, they don't. The classic physics and optical people use one definition of polarization, particularly circular polarization, and the radio people use an entirely different definition, and they're 180 degrees out of phase with each other, if you know what I mean. So when it comes to circular polarization, what is a clockwise circular wave? The classic physics people and the radio people got the exact opposite definition for a clockwise wave, and boy, does that create problems from time to time. So just giving you a little bit of warning that when you get into circular, there's a lot of ambiguity, as you can tell, and that has created lawsuits when somebody ordered one and got the other. Okay, Joe's the next guy who signed it, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. What's going on in your neighborhood these days, Joe? K-2-R-I-W in the tech net.
Oh, not too much, W-H-Y-Y. Here's your question. This is actually very simple. You might be surprised I asked something like this, but anyway. I was reading, going through some different problems in a FCC book for GRL. And one of my, and I just wanted to understand a little more about how, it has to do with between true power and apparent power and so forth. And basically the problem is this. They give you something like this. You have a 5-volt AC source, a 100-ohm resistor connected in series with a capacitor that has a reactance of 75 ohms. Resistor's value is 100 ohms. I know in a series circuit the current's going to be the same, but the voltage apparently across each component seems to add up to more than what the supply voltage is. Can you explain such?
Yeah, we're now getting into the subject of phase shift, Joe. And when it comes to phase shift and how you represent it on an oscilloscope, a fair number of electronic people have a good deal of trouble with that. Whenever you combine a resistor and a reactor in series, and a reactor could be either a capacitor or an inductor, and by the way, every real inductor and every real capacitor, no matter how ideal it is, no matter how many dollars you spend for it, has a little bit of equivalent series resistance built inside. No capacitor is perfect, no inductor is perfect. In the case of an inductor, you get a hint about the series resistance by putting your ohm meter on the inductor and waiting for your ohm meter to settle down. In the case of capacitor, to find out the equivalent capacitive equivalent series resistance, a little bit more difficult. But the overall impedance of the pair follows a Pythagorean theorem, a right-angle triangle law. In other words, if one leg of the triangle is the ohms of the resistance, of reactants, and those two legs of the triangle are at right angles to each other, the hypotenuse of the triangle tells you the total total impedance as a number of ohms. So square root of the sum of the squares. You square the resistance value, add it to the square of the reactance value, sum the two together, take the square root of the result. That's the length of the hypotenuse. That's the total amount of impedance of that circuit. Once you know that amount of impedance and you know the applied voltage, you divide the applied voltage by that impedance and you know the current that's flowing. So that allows you to calculate the amperes of current flow. But there's a catch. Let me drop. If you now use your oscilloscope in a careful way where you can measure the voltage waveform that's being applied, and now you measure the current, looking at the voltage drop across the resistor. Because the nice thing about a resistor is that for every volt drop, for every ohm of resistance, you know you're going to have 1 ampere flowing. And the resistor itself never creates a phase shift. But because it's in series with the capacitor, you will get a phase shift. And so by measuring the phase shift of the voltage drop across the resistor, you know the phase shift of the whole circuit. And you get something there called power factor. Whenever you apply voltage drop, squared R, E squared over R, allows you to calculate how many watts are being dissipated by the resistor. But once there's a reactor in there, the phase shift starts coming into effect, the power factor starts coming into effect, that you take the cosine of the phase angle, and all of a sudden you get more reactive power than resistive power. When you're buying something like a signal generator, a motor generator set, that motor generator set is capable of generating a certain number of amperes at a certain number of volts, and you'd like to multiply the two together and say it's watts. And if it was RMS current and RMS voltage, you multiply together, you would have watts if and only if there is no phase shift. But once there's a phase shift, that really means that some of the power goes into the capacitor and comes back out of it. Let me give you the worst case example. I've got a 50-ohm transmission line. And I've got 50 volts coming down that transmission line from my transmitter. And I've got a capacitor at the end of the transmission line, a pure capacitor. I've carefully adjusted that capacitor so that it has exactly 50 ohms of capacitive reactance at this frequency I'm operating at. So I've got a 50-ohm transmission line, and I put a capacitive load at the end, a pure capacitor, of 50 ohms of capacitive reactance. I could ask 10 engineers in the companies that I've worked at, what will be the standing wave ratio of that situation? And half of them approximately will say, hey, you've got a 50-ohm load and a 50-ohm transmission line. That's a 1-to-1 standard wave ratio. And then I start saying, okay, how many watts are being absorbed by the capacitor? I eventually get them to admit that if it's a pure capacitor, it absorbs no power. You cannot put power continuously dissipated by a pure capacitor or a pure inductor. Let me drop. You could say, if you wanted to, that on the first half cycle, you're loading voltage and current into that capacitor, and it's storing some energy. On the second half of the cycle, you could say the capacitor gives up that energy, gives it back to the load. It absorbs no power in a continuous manner. On each half cycle, it's doing something, but in the big picture, it absorbs no power. Because it's absorbing no power, every one of the watts you sent down that line must reflect back to you. The standing wave ratio is infinity. The power reflected ratio, or the voltage reflection ratio, the network analyzer people will call it the parameter S11. No matter what words you use for it, all the power going down that line is going to reflect back to you when you've got a pure inductive, a pure reactive load. Now the real world has got partial inductance, partial reactance, and partial resistance. And yes, when you add up the voltage across the capacitor, and you add up the voltage across the resistor, and you put the two together, it works. Let me drop. And that's because they're at right angles to each other. In the case of a right triangle, assume now that I've got a 45 degree right triangle. I've got unity for the voltage on the resistance. I got unity on the voltage across the reactant. And if you add the two together, you'd come up with a number of 2. In reality, the hypotenuse is square root of 2. So in other words, the individual voltages add in a funny way because of the phase shift that occurs. And by the way, you would have 45 degrees of phase shift in that particular example I just gave. Because the phase shift allows each of those devices to be equivalent to the legs of a triangle, a right triangle, and the sum of the legs is always going to be bigger than the hypotenuse. That's a partial explanation. But because of the phase shift, they don't add in the normal manner. You've got to now start using some trigonometry. I know this is only part of the story. I know if you're hearing it under a particular method of discussion, and therefore it's not going to make a whole lot of sense at first, Joe, but this is the beginning of your understanding of it. So B2RYY, wait for all four beeps, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, thanks, Dick. K2RIW from K4NBC. Yeah, my question is, I'm building a 10-meter antenna, 29 megahertz, and it's I'm copying a four-bay decibel products antenna. Four half-wave dipoles side-mounted on the tower, all of which are phased together. And for the 220, 440, you know, 2-meter antenna, they use a 75-ohm hardline in the phasing harness. On the low-band model, however, the 10-meter low-band antenna model, the 25 to 30 meg one, they're using 35 megahertz. 35-ohm phasing lines. They're using 275-ohm cables in parallel. And I was wondering what the deal was with the 35-ohm phasing harnesses. Is it due to there being so much extra inductance because there's so much more longer, metal or antenna elements that they have to cut the capacitive reactance in half? That's my question for the evening, Dick. Back to you from K4NBC in the state of Florida.
WB2HW, would you like to be put in for a comment on the previous subject?
Okay, Howie, we got you on the list. When it comes to matching four individual elements, in your case, you got, I think it's a vertical collinear that you're building, although it doesn't have to be vertical. In other words, you could have four vertically polarized dipoles stacked along one leg of the tower, or they could be four dipoles horizontally polarized. That's your choice whether or not you got horizontal or vertical. But in either case, you've got a vertical stack of antennas, which give you a reasonably omnidirectional pattern in azimuth, a very sharp pattern in elevation, so that if you could draw a computer-generated plot, a three-dimensional plot of an antenna pattern, it would either look like a pancake or look like a horizontal beaver tail. So it's an antenna giving you a lot more gain. In theory, you can get 6 dB more gain than the gain of any one of the elements. And you've got a narrow vertical beamwidth. That's where the gain is coming from. And you could have as much as 360 degrees of azimuth beamwidth, depending on how it's set up. Now, the only main criteria you've got when you're feeding those four elements is that you want the four elements to definitely be fed in phase. If they were slightly different in phase, you would have up tilt or down tilt on the signal radiated in the manner of that horizontal beaver tail or that pancake. The pancake could become a slight conic, a conic-shaped object, but the cone is tilted upward or tilted downward. So your highest priority is to make sure that the phase arriving at each of the four antennas are in phase with each other, plus or minus a few degrees. You don't have to go crazy with that. There are guys who think the accuracy has got to be 1 degree. As long as it's a random error of 20 degrees, it would make very little difference in the game. Let me drop. Feeding all four antennas in phase is your highest priority. Your second highest priority is to try to feed equal power to each of the antennas if you want maximum gain. And by the way, if you tapered the power, if the two center elements had a little bit more power than the edge elements, you'd have a slightly cleaner pattern as far as side lobes are concerned. And it's easy to fall into the trap of thinking that the lower side lobe means that there's more power in the main lobe. That's sort of true, and therefore you're going to have higher efficiency. Well, be careful now. Efficiency of the main lobe, you really care about gain. You don't, when it comes to some extra side lobes above the horizon or below the horizon, you don't really worry about that. So don't fall into the trap of thinking that making the side lobes go to zero is desirable. There are cases where it's definitely not desirable. In your particular case, your first vertical side lobe is going to be something like 12 dB down. 12 and a half dB down is the calculation with reasonable spacing. So equal power, equal phase, those are your two criteria. Your third criteria, let me drop. Your third criteria in the way you're feeding this phased array, and that's what it really is. It's a kind of vertically stacked phased array antenna. And now you want it to present a good impedance match to your transmission line. And if your transmission line is 50 ohms, you would like the main corporate feed point, the main common feed point for these four antennas before the phasing harness begins, to be 50 ohms. you'll soon discover there's a large number of ways that you can meet all three criteria simultaneously. You can combine two antennas at a time, the two upper ones, combine two at a time, the two lower ones, and then take those two pairs and combine those. That would be a 2x2x2 is one way of doing it, and you could do that with T-connectors, for instance. But when you're putting two antennas together, if you're putting the two antennas together with equal lengths of line into a T-connector, you're putting a pair of 50-ohm antennas, we'll say, in parallel, and that's going to make 25 ohms. Now the 25 ohms looks like a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. It is. However, if the length of line from that first T-connector to the next T-connector was a quarter wavelength of line, a quarter wavelength of line is an impedance inverter. The 25 ohms, which is half the impedance of the 50-ohm line in my example, will become a 100-ohm load. So now the upper two antennas give you a 100-ohm load. The bottom two antennas give you a 100-ohm load. You put those two together in a T-connector, 200s in parallel come back to 50. That's one of many ways of doing it. So by combining them in parallel and using quarter wavelengths of line, you can get a good impedance match. You can also doing it by taking a 75-ohm line, a quarter wavelength of it, and if the antenna happened to be a 50-ohm line, each individual antenna would give you an apparent 100-ohm impedance. When you take a 50-ohm antenna and a 75-ohm line, that's a quarter wavelength long. So in
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Inside of the intermediate steps of your phasing harness, depending on how you want it, the quarter wave impedance inverting factor allows the small frequency where the length of line becomes significant. They may have decided to choose the technique that uses the least amount of line length. And yes, putting a pair of 70-ohm coax cables in parallel does give you a 35-ohm cable. Or putting a pair of 50-ohm cables in parallel gives you a 25-ohm cable. And there's lots of combinations. So is one technique better than another? Probably not. But there's a large number of ways of doing it. You could even have a simple 4-to-1 power divider. By, in other words, putting all four antennas in parallel, giving you 12.5 ohms, and that 4-to-1 power divider device would be a quarter wavelength long, and you take the 12.5 ohms, multiply it by 50, take the square root of that, and it's going to come out something like 30 ohms or 25 ohms, and so if the piece of line in between the 4-to-1 connector and the single connector on the other end happen to be the right impedance, in one step you can do an impedance match. So do you use a 4-to-1 power divider with equal length of line beyond those? And by the way, the line lengths don't have to be equal. You can make the intervals of a wavelength different if you like, and they'll still come out in phase. So a 4-to-1 power divider, a triple of 2-to-1 power dividers, a bunch of non-power dividers with T connectors, and the right length of cable, there's a large number of ways of doing it. And so with a little more study, you'll find out that you could change the way they did it if you want to, and it's not going to explode. As long as you meet the three criteria, it's going to fly, Bob.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
And even if you have any doubt, you could set up the whole thing before you put it on the tower. You could lay the whole thing horizontal on a piece of pipe. You connect the four antennas to a piece of pipe that's laying horizontal on your ground. And, suspend them up above the ground a little bit by way of a wooden sawhorses or whatever, and then by way of using an oscilloscope the right way, you could literally measure the phase angle of the signal that's getting to each one of the dipoles and the amplitude of the signal that's going to each one of the dipoles. You could do a complete test of that antenna on the ground if you wanted to confirm that they're all getting the right power at the right phase, and then while it's on the ground, you could rotate the whole thing and measure the elevation pattern even though it's a horizontal antenna. You'd be amazed how much testing you can do on the ground before you put it up on the air if you want to be double darn sure that you're not wasting a lot of time holding it up 190 feet of tower, if you know what I mean, and then finding out there's an error in the system. K4 NBC, K2LIW in the TechNet.
All right, K2RIW, K for NBC. Experience has taught me that antennas anywhere near the proximity of the ground, detune, and you get them up on the tower, you got to retune them again. But, you know, that wasn't, that's another subject. All right, well, thanks for answering my question, Dick. That's pretty much what I thought. Just wanted to get a second opinion there. I thought electrical tilt may come into play there if I didn't do that. All right, back to you. K2, RIW from K4, and DC, in the borough of Florida.
I think it's the state of Florida. The borough of Florida. All right, I'll take your word for it. You know, Seinfeld said that when you hit 65 years of age, you have to retire to Florida. It's the law. In the case of these four dipoles, if they were going to be horizontally polarized on the tower, which means they're going to be vertically polarized when you got this whole piece of pipe laying on the ground, and then if you've got the piece of pipe, well, let me pick a number, with wooden support structure, you got the pipe on each end 10 feet off the ground, the amount of ground reflection you're going to get is going to be so darn small that it's not going to be much of a problem. If it's a vertically polarized stack, I'll admit it's going to be a little bit more of a problem. However, the ground reflection is going to have an equal performance impact on each one of the dipoles. Therefore, the overall standing wave ratio you measure at the common port of that quad of four antennas is going to be a little bit different on the ground than it is on the tower. And by knowing the number of wavelengths you are above the ground, you could even predict that. In other words, you could do a computer model on that and know exactly how much offset the standing wave ratio was created because of ground reflection. So if you're smart enough, there are ways of living with ground reflection. And as you raise this whole thing further and further away from the ground, yes, that's going to become less and less. If it was Yagi antennas you were stacking, and now during your ground test you got the Yagis aimed straight up in the air, life becomes very simple. So there's lots of ways you can check this all out. In order to confirm that the right power at the right phase angle is going to the four antennas, you could put four dummy loads for the four antennas and therefore confirm that. So there's lots of ways of doing it, Bob. Come back and let us know how that array turns out. And on 10 meters with your altitude, with that much gain, on those four antennas, and with the kind of band openings we're getting on 10 meters these days as the sunspot cycle starts coming back to life, that could be an awful lot of fun antenna. I'm pretty sure you're going to be talking with much higher probability up to Howie there. That would be to HWW. You're going to be talking to him on 10 meters into his repeater from time to time. I see it coming. A lot more frequently, in other words. Okay, Kevin's the next guy. KB2, Baker Alpha Hotel. Go right here with your question, Kevin. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. I should have a question, an update for you. I hope you remember me you spoke about 2, maybe 3 weeks ago regarding my van where I told you I had an 11-meter setup. I was actually adding my 2-meter 440 stuff. I was worried about having power conflicts between the antennas because the antenna array is going to be so close on the van.
Yes, I do remember predicting that although the antennas are real close, which means if you tried to transmit on one band while receiving on the other, that could give you some grief because overloading a receiver is pretty easy to do. But when it comes to how transparent is the 2-meter antenna when you're transmitting on 440, or how transparent is the 11-meter antenna when you're on either of the other bands, the good news is that those antennas are amazingly transparent. In other words, you could do a test with the what you think is the offending antenna being present or being removed, and you measure performance of the antenna in question, and I think you're going to be very pleasantly surprised that an antenna has great performance on the design frequency. It is essentially not there on all other frequencies. I brought to your attention the fact that there are a number of military installations where they put 2, 3, and 4 separate frequency regions with whip antennas on the exact same bumper of the exact same Jeep-like vehicle or Humvee-like vehicle, and as long as they've got high enough quality bandpass filters on each of those four antennas, on each of those four transceivers, They all can run simultaneously without interfering with each other. So it's a matter now of having the right amount of filtering. The other antenna is essentially not there. So I wonder if you've started running that experiment. I wonder if you've started to get partial confirmation of that, Kevin. KB2, BAH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, what I'm actually doing is I got my 2 meter 448 antenna. I actually put it up on the band. And as you said, so far with the power levels that I'm running, if I'm running them simultaneously, I get a little bit of a radio, which is, again, expected because I'm using it at the same time. But if I'm just using one or the other, I don't get no interference with one or the other. I've also noticed that it does not make me more directional at all. It's completely, as far as I can tell so far with the power levels that I'm running, the two separate antenna systems are absolutely totally transparent to each other. And actually yesterday with a friend of mine, I had an opportunity to test to see if it was directional at all, if the other antennas were causing any interference to cause me to be directional. And the same test showed that it's not making me more directional or anything either. But I just wanted to give you an update. But I'm going to be doing more tests down the road with a lot of my power levels, and then that's when the real tests will come in. And same thing, I'll come back to you with that and give you an update on that as well.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're going to confirm that each of the antennas on different frequencies are essentially transparent. The 2 meter antenna doesn't see the 440, the 440 doesn't see the 2, both of them don't see the 11 meter antenna, and so on. They're all transparent to each other. When it comes to transmitting pattern, when it comes to standing wave ratio of transmission, when it comes to efficiency, the only thing to slightly worry about is what is the coupling coefficient. If, for instance, you are going to run 1,000 watts on, let's say, 2 meters, and you're worried about how much energy is going to be coupled into the 11-meter antenna or into the 440 antenna, is there enough energy going to be coupled that there's a slim possibility it could give you some damage to the front end in the receive mode? And even if that was going to happen, the right kind of a filter would make that problem go away, bandpass filters, and you can measure it ahead of time. The nice thing about measuring the insertion loss between two different antennas on the same vehicle, let me drop, is that the number of decibels of insertion loss that you measure is not power sensitive. You could make the measurement at the milliwatt level if you've got a sensitive enough detector. You could make the measurement at the watt level or at the kilowatt level. Under reasonable circumstances, you will get the exact same number of decibels of insertion loss between the antennas. So no matter what instrumentation you use, as long as it's reasonably calibrated, you know, with a 2-to-1 accuracy, so to speak, you can then find out, okay, the coupling between the 2-meter antenna and the 11-meter antenna is 21 decibels of insertion loss between the two. Once you know that, even though you've measured it at the 1 milliwatt level, let me round off the number and make it 30 dB. Let's assume you had 30 decibels of insertion loss between antenna A and antenna B. 30 dB, I chose that because it's a 1,000-to-1 ratio. Then you know that once you've measured that insertion loss, if you decide to run 1,000 watts on an antenna A, the amount of power that will get into antenna B's receiver will be 1,000-to-1 lower, 1 watt. So 1,000 watts into A, with 30 dB of loss, will be 1 watt into B, and now you have to worry about can the receiver, with its protection diodes and filter and whatever, can it tolerate 1 watt, or will damage occur? So if you wanted to, you could either do it as just a brute force test, run the power and see if anything happens, because repairing the front end is not a showstopper. When you got somebody like Andy, WA2CDL, who can fix anything, it doesn't matter if you do damage and then the process of finding out. But the scientific way is to make the real measurement, and then you can predict ahead of time whether or not it's going to give you any grief. Back to you with that, and keep telling us as the experiment proceeds, Kevin, what you find.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Copy that. All right, thank you very much. I just want to jump in and give an update on that. Like I said, down the road, as the power increases and I get things where I want it to be, I'll absolutely come back and give you updates. as it goes along. Dick, thank you very much. KB2BAH. I'm clear.
WB2HWW.
Okay, go ahead, Howie.
I just, let me let this cycle. We wanted to make a comment on the original comment, the subject of RYY. Might be interesting to pick up a high school book or even a introductory book to rectangular and polar coordinates. I mean, sometimes you want to, you know, write that. Let's say you had a three ohm resistor and 4 ohms of capacitance. You know, that would be 5 at 53 degrees. You know, you want to know how to write it. You know, magnitude at an angle, polar, rectangular coordinates. You know, when you add in rectangular. When you divide or multiply, you do it in polar coordinates. And it's a lot of fun, and you learn a lot, Dick. Obviously, you know this. If you, without a calculator, you do it by hand, you go through all the calculations and see how the various different combinations add up, you know, as the different phase angles. When you're doing dividing, you know, you change the signs. All of those rules about adding and multiplying. Back to you, Dick.
And if you're using rectangular paper, but doing a polar plot on the paper, or if you're using polar plot paper and you make sure that you represent the resistance in one direction and that right angle to it, you represent the reactant in the other direction. In either case, the answer you're getting really is the Pythagorean theorem. It's the right triangle. You're calculating the length of the hypotenuse, that is the total impedance, and the length of each of the two legs represents the resistive component and the reactive component, and the angles you get between them is telling you the phase angle. So it really does relate back to trigonometry. When we all took that trigonometry course in high school, and at the time it didn't sound like it's going to have very much application to us, so as you become a ham radio operator and you start running into reactive circuits, it can have a lot of good application. Already, of the people who signed in at first, I think we've answered all of them. Let's make sure I haven't skipped anybody. If so, speak now. K2RIW in the TechNet. And I think the answer is no. Didn't hear Mel sign in, so maybe he's not available tonight. If so, he can break in any time he wants to. If not, let's go over to Paul. And Paul with our space report. I think I've heard, Paul, that the Russians were launching a spacecraft to Mars this week, and I think they've had a communication failure, if I've heard the report correctly. I didn't get a chance to check on that one. WS2N, what's NASA doing and what's Russia doing? K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is Paul, WS2N. That thing was called a Phobos Grunt. They have plans on sending this thing to Mars and going to Phobos, the moon, the bigger moon of Mars. They plan on landing it there, picking up a small amount of soil, rocks or whatever, and bringing it back to Earth. So it was actually a Mars moon return mission. And they got it into Earth orbit. And they have problems with the spacecraft. They're trying to communicate with it now to try to send it on its way. Apparently the rocket is not firing. So, I heard they were working feverishly to get this thing to get back up and running because it's got like 7 tons of hydrazine gas on board, fuel. And it would be the heaviest toxic thing that ever comes back into the Earth's atmosphere. If it does, drop it. So, Phobos Grunt, it's still, I checked last night, and it was still in Earth orbit, pretty low, too. Like the space station is up, 250 miles? This thing's around, 110 or so, 115 miles up. So it's relatively low, which means it won't take long to deorbit. They're looking at the beginning of December,
a couple of 3 weeks before this thing comes out of orbit. So you're right about that, Dick. Big problems for the Russians. They've had a couple of problems recently with that Progress ship they wanted to send to the space station with the failed rocket, although that seems to have been corrected. So hopefully they get this thing back on track, but last I heard, they said it don't look good. Whatever they're sending up to it is, you know, signal-wise, it's not working. They're trying to reboot it, trying to actually reboot their computer on board. I don't know. NASA's trying to help them out as well because they have tracking. They're tracking it, giving them as much data as they can. Let me drop it to WS2. And we talked about Mars Curiosity quite a bit here, so I have a final launch date this month on the 25th. It's Friday, and it's going to be a morning launch, 10:25. So set your VCRs, DVDs, or DVRs, whatever it is, or your computer to see if that thing matches its predicted animations. The animations we don't see, the animation that we see is usually with the cruise stage, starting with the cruise stage going into eventually going into Mars atmosphere. But we don't see the launch. All these other rockets have gone up to Mars, for instance, the Pathfinder, it's a small Sojourner crawler that they had, the size of a microwave oven, and then Opportunity and Spirit were all launched by Delta rockets, Delta 2, WS2N. Let me drop it. This thing is a little on a big side, like about five times bigger than the Mars Opportunity and Spirit. So they put it onto a bigger rocket, the Atlas V. Atlas has been around a long time, but this is the latest of the Atlas series, so it's a very big rocket. And we'll see how that goes on a couple of Fridays from now. And we'll see, I think that was the next Friday, I think, right? I don't know, the 25th. So that's that. I wanted to bring up the Orion missions. We don't have a manned space program really right now by the United States, but the first flight test, it'll be unmanned, will be 2014, and NASA now has an animation of what that will look like. I'm not talking about what the one that they've had, the one they had with the actual launch from the ground, the Space Launch System. That's that big rocket bigger than the Saturn V. They've had that up for a while, but now they have a new one of what it would look like of the Orion spacecraft that, attached to its third stage, and how that's going to work out. And they show it going to a very big orbit, in a higher orbit than anything we've done since the early 1970s, with the launch of the final manned mission to the moon. So this will have that capability. It's a nice, get a good idea of what it's going to look like. One other thing, Expedition 29, that is a manned flight from Russia, from Baikonur.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, you did time out for about three quarters of a minute where you talked about the Expedition 29, which is launching tomorrow, where you did mention, Paul, that we're not going to have an Orion-like vehicle. We're going to be doing an unmanned test in 2014. By the time we fully qualify it, it's probably going to be closer to 2015, which is 4 years away before we have a launch capability to send astronauts and cosmonauts to the International Space Station. So we've got approximately 4 years to go before there's a substitute for the Soyuz. the Soviet way of launching and returning. What's a rough guess, Paul, as to how many expeditions to the International Space Station, how many launches